From KLW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents, context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
Berkeley.
Hercules, California.
Bubble Park City College.
South San Francisco.
Downtown.
OTL.
Pittsburgh.
P-World.
Oakland.
Corona Heights, San Francisco.
Coming up, we'll check out a program that's helping kids overcome social barriers through the power of play.
When I didn't know how to play basketball or anything, boys made fun of me, and then when I started playing, they're like, wow.
And speaking of fun, we'll also celebrate the future of San Francisco's Exploratorium with the people who've been part of its past.
I've got to done these amazing things here at the Exploratorium. That's why I've been here for 40 years.
Later this year, the new Bay Bridge will open, but it might not get the same reception as the original did.
Go across the bridge for a quarter.
We're spanning time, space, and monkey bars today on Cross Currents. I can't believe it, but I'm old enough to start a sentence with back in my day. When it comes to kids playing outside, I have to say, back in my day, that's just what kids did. You played outside, sometimes all day. But now there are Nintendo Wiis and tablets and TVs in cars. A recent study by the Kaiser Family Foundation found that kids between 8 and 19 years old spend an average of 7.5 hours a day in front of some type of screen. And now that schools are cutting back on recess, kids simply are not getting enough time to just play. Play is actually important. A growing body of research suggests it's essential to kids' social, emotional, and physical development. Reporter Jen Chien brings us the story of one Oakland organization that's getting serious about fun and games.
Morning recess at Ruby Bridges Elementary School is a boisterous affair. It's made even louder today by a strong wind blowing across the concrete yard, billowing kids' shirts and ruffling their hair. Over at one end of the long yard is a playing field where Coach Kenny Wong is supervising about 20 kids. They're playing Capture the Flag, a pretty common game. But there's something uncommon happening here, as Principal Jan Goodman explains.
There's Coach Kenny out there, and he's playing a game, and he's got some fifth graders in it, but there's also some first graders playing with them. And so the bigger kids are kind of taking care of the little kids in that game.
Now, usually at this age, the size and social difference among these kids keep them from playing together to make sure the younger kids don't get hurt. But recess has been different here at Ruby Bridges since the school brought in a program called Playworks. Coach Kenny is a Playworks employee, and he's out in the yard with the kids almost all day long.
We have two recesses in the morning, the three lunch recesses, and one afternoon recess. And at all those recesses, he has the kids learn cooperative games that teach sportsmanship, fairness, and respect, and are really fun at the same time. So that's kind of cool to be able to do that.
Coach Kenny also leads a junior coach program where kids in the upper grades act as his assistants in the yard. Fourth grader Isabella Ratto is one of them.
We get to tell kids how to follow the rules and what to do and be respectful with the balls in the games.
And if that didn't happen, what do you think would happen?
There'd be a lot of fights and fights.
Playworks is a national nonprofit based in Oakland with the goal of bringing organized play to schools. But what exactly is organized play? And why would you need it at recess?
We want the kids at the end of recess to feel like they're ready to learn when they come back.
Again, Principal Goodman.
Generally, the problems that we have on the yard are usually between kids who either are arguing about a game rule, and that's where the junior coaches come in, or if they just have nothing to do, so they just go from one place to another kind of bothering people because they're lost. So we want them to feel good about themselves by the time they go back in so they don't bring any baggage from recess.
Playworks founder Jill Violet used to run a children's art museum where she heard many principals complain about recess at their schools. In a TED Talk from 2011, she describes meeting with one principal, frazzled after a disciplinary meeting with three little boys.
She's talking about how these three boys get in trouble every day, and they're not bad kids, but they're starting to see themselves as bad kids.
Violet says these kinds of conversations motivated her to dig into this issue, and what she found is something that's becoming common knowledge. Today's kids are not getting the same opportunities for free, creative play that previous generations have had. The rise of entertainment technology and video games, along with an emphasis on achievement and testing in schools, has led to kids getting less practice at just playing with each other. And play, Violet believes, is essential to a child's intellectual development.
The philosopher Bernard Suits said he defined a game as being the voluntary attempt to overcome an unnecessary challenge. Isn't that great? I mean, they choose it. It's a challenge. It's no longer should you think of play as being the opposite of work or the purview of slackers. It is the fundamental sign of our inner drive and ambition.
In a large carpeted conference room, PlayWorks trainer Brady Gill is leading a session for after-school staff from several Oakland elementary schools. Gill trains teachers in PlayWorks philosophy and methods. Right now, about 40 adults are running crazily around the room. The full PlayWorks program, with a full-time PlayWorks coach on site, is expensive, about $25,000 a year per school. So PlayWorks offers these trainings to schools that can't afford the whole program. The adults actually have to get up and play the games. And then they discuss the values or messages that might be operating under the surface. For example, that old chestnut, tag, you're it.
Because kids have a lot of negative connotations with it. They don't want it. It keeps them from playing games. What if I'm it?
PlayWorks trainer Brady Gill.
And what if I'm running around and I can't tag anyone, or people see that I'm it all the time? What does that mean about me, you know?
So PlayWorks teaches variations of tag where half the group, or even everyone, is it at once, taking the fear of being singled out of the equation.
Ultimately, that's a lot of times what kids and adults are feeling. We don't want to lose. We don't want to fail.
After-school teacher Chioke Clinton says that while he doesn't believe educational games can solve all the behavior issues at the schools he serves, he appreciates the new perspective he's gained today.
Well, I never really looked at the value of games as far as instilling the principle of overcoming barriers. Social barriers and our own personal fear, you know, that we internalize that keeps us from accomplishing our goals because we're, you know, we're afraid of failing, we're afraid of being out.
According to PlayWorks, the values of sports personship really do start with the words you use. So there are three things Coach Kenny has taught the kids to say before they start a game. The junior coaches give it a try into the mic.
Play hard, respect the game, and have fun.
Teamwork.
Let's do that one more time.
Respect the game, have fun, and play hard.
Teamwork.
They may not have it down perfectly, but they've definitely got the right idea. In Alameda, I'm Jen Cheehan for Cross Currents.
PlayWorks has created a national model for this work, and they're getting a lot of attention for it. But there are many other programs promoting structured play. You can find a list at kalw.org. And while you're there, you can let us know where and how do your kids play, and what does it mean to them? Share your story at 415-264-7106. Again, the number to leave us a message about what play means in your life is 415-264-7106.
Hop along, Peter Raycorn. Hop along, Peter Raycorn. Hop along, Peter, won't you bear in mind? I ain't coming back till the gooseberry time.
You're listening to Cross Currents. I'm Holly Kernan. There's a place in San Francisco where play is built into every nook and cranny, and it's hidden in plain sight. The iconic Palace of Fine Arts in San Francisco is truly a beauty to behold. It's hard to believe that behind that grand rotunda and romantic lagoon is the city's biggest playground for our tiny tinkerers and future scientists. For 44 years, the Exploratorium has attracted more than 500,000 visitors from all over the globe every year, and it's helped design exhibits for approximately 700 other international science centers. Now, the self-described learning laboratory is on the move. On January 2nd, the Exploratorium closed its doors in the marina, and it's preparing to open in April at Pier 15 on the Embarcadero. KALW's Nina Gensler-Debs grew up visiting the Exploratorium, and she attended a recent farewell party. She talked to members, employees, and volunteers about what the museum has meant to the Bay Area thus far and what it will likely become.
Science is rarely easy to understand and even harder to explain.
Well, it's more like the soap. It's more like molecules that are come together and they like stick together. And it's like, it's more, you can't see them, but they're like sort of like invisible.
But here at the Exploratorium, science isn't hard. It's fun. Because in order to learn, you have to play.
Sometimes you actually can poke them and they'll pop, and then you can blow another one, and then they'll pop again.
What Isidro Demery is describing is the soap bubble tray, and it's pretty much what it's called, a big tray with pools of soapy water. As he pulls several metal hoops out of the tray, a trail of rainbow bubbles follows. It's simple, but surprisingly cool, especially because I played with the same exhibit when I was 6 years old, then again when I was 10, and now I watched as it's used for one of the last times before it leaves for a new home.
And they're like really huge and they're amazing to look at.
This is one of over 1,000 exhibits that are on rotating display at the Exploratorium, and there's clearly no age limit for enjoying them.
Well, I've been introduced to the Exploratorium in probably the early 80s, and I've been a member since about that time, since maybe 1983.
Jack Schiffhauer lives in San Jose, but travels to the city whenever he can to spend time at the Exploratorium. He has all kinds of memories here, including seeing Frank Zappa perform, but one of his favorites is of the Tactile Dome, one of the most popular exhibits. Visitors must make their way through the pitch-black dome by touch only. Imagine people groping for ladders and feeling their way gingerly through tunnels. When I was in high school, there were more than a few stories of teens using it as a space to steal some kisses. Schiffhauer's memory there was during a birthday party.
And one of the cousins was too young. He was, I think, maybe 4 years old, and I crawled through the tactile dome with him on my back. And so that was a double experience of both exposing him to all the perceived dangers as well as all of the interesting effects of the tactile dome.
The Tactile Dome is one of the exhibits that will travel to the Exploratorium's new location at Pier 15, but it will be completely rebuilt and the old one decommissioned. Several of the site-specific exhibits will not be moving, including a camera obscura piece, which projected surrounding images of the Exploratorium onto a screen, the Rotunda Echo, where visitors can make noise outside and hear the vibrating sounds of their own echoes, and the sound column, which goes like this.
We hung a swing from the very, very top of the museum, and we had a cherry picker in at the same time to fix our gas heaters. So if you can imagine people jumping off a cherry picker 40 feet in the air on this giant swing that was hanging from the roof, there's a lot of those kinds of stories.
That's Ron Hipschman. He's worked at the Exploratorium almost as long as it's been open. He's on his 42nd year. He started in high school working with founder Frank Oppenheimer and has done all kinds of things here since then. When he hands me his business card, I notice his job title is Loose Cannon. He also serves as a living catalog of endless stories, like the cherry picker swing, and also
people riding their motorcycles inside the building, sometimes successfully and sometimes less successfully.
Frank Oppenheimer, the physicist, professor, and founder of the Exploratorium, discovered this empty exhibit hall in 1969 and decided it would be the perfect location for his, quote, San Francisco project.
This was basically the building shed for the Panama Pacific Exhibition back in 1915 or 17.
This is Vincent Ritchie. He's on the board of the Exploratorium.
And the Palace of Fine Arts out front of us is the only remaining structure from that fair. And this place was just this big old barn behind it. And when Frank Oppenheimer came to San Francisco with this idea to establish a science museum, the city was interested in sort of leasing this place for, I think, a dollar a year or something.
It's true. Oppenheimer did lease the hall for $1 a year. And the museum's opening was just about as glamorous as its setting.
People just started wandering in. Frank looked up and said, oh, I guess we're open. We had no grand opening, no funders that we had to invite for a grand opening. So that was really rare, I think, but let us kind of grow organically.
Despite all of the stories and the nostalgia, Ron Hipschman is excited about the move to Pier 15.
It's going to be different, but it's going to be new opportunities. We're going to do a lot more environmental stuff in the new building that's really exciting to us. We're going to put sensors on this building that will be able to measure the weather, atmospheric quality, water quality. We'll be able to monitor that now and tell those kind of stories through data.
Pier 15's 9 acres will allow for 150 more exhibits than the old location. Again, museum member Jack Schiffhauer.
There's a fond feeling toward the garage, as I like to think of it. It's kind of a tinkering shop. But they're going to equally inspiring location. So I think that if they were going to pick anywhere, that would be the place to pick.
Frank Oppenheimer chose the exhibit hall at the Palace of Fine Arts so we'd have room to play and experiment. At Pier 15, we'll get to do the same, but now the museum has room to grow, and we'll see about the motorcycles. For Cross Currents, I'm Nina Gensler-Debs.
You can share your memories of the old Exploratorium and your stories about the new one at our Facebook page. We're KALW News. This is Cross Currents. I'm Holly Kernan. The Exploratorium is an example of a place that's very meaningful to a lot of people. KALW's Lisa Ratner recently stopped by another local icon, one that's so prominent we can almost miss it, Treasure Island.
It's interesting how people that I've talked to about it, how few people have actually been. So I really recommend checking it out. And since going, I've been popping by it almost every time I drive from Oakland to San Francisco because I'm just so curious to see how the skyline is and just, you know, what I'm going to see next.
So I'm Tiffany Blejo, originally from Florida. I now live in Oakland. And every single day I hear some version of, I've lived in the Bay Area my whole life or for 20 years, but this is my first time on the island. It's so isolated. People don't come here that much. The view is a million-dollar view. You have the view of the entire city, Alcatraz, the Golden Gate Bridge. There are some of the old buildings that are left over from the World's Fair. I believe when you first drive in, that half-circular building, which was also used in an Indiana Jones movie.
The quest for the Grail is not archaeology. It's a race against evil.
Metallica came in. They were filming a movie across the street. So we had Metallica workers coming in every day for lunch and dinner for 3 months. And we have, when the movies are shooting on here, sometimes we'll do the catering for the movies. And yeah, it's just very unique. You kind of have to experience it.
Is there a place that's important to you? We're asking you to share it with KALW's Community Storytelling Project, Hear Here. Just go to Hear Here, that's H-E-A-R-H-E-R-E dot K-A-L-W dot O-R-G. Again, that's H-E-A-R-H-E-R-E dot K-A-L-W dot O-R-G and tell us about a place in the Bay Area that's special for you. And when you do that, you can see our map of all of the places people have already shared. Again, that's herehere dot K-A-L-W dot O-R-G. You're listening to Cross Currents. I'm Holly Kernan. Treasure Island anchors another local icon, the Bay Bridge. After 11 years of construction, the bridge's majestic new eastern span is set to open to traffic this fall. It's hard to imagine the Bay without the Bay Bridge, but it hasn't always been with us. And that's why ROHO, the Regional Oral History Office, which is part of UC Berkeley's Bancroft Library, is collecting stories from people who were there when the original Bay Bridge opened to keep those memories alive.
Sam Redman from Rojo has recorded a number of interviews with folks who recall that time. He came by recently and shared excerpts with KALW's Stephen Short.
The clips that I'm sharing today happen to be people who were just in the Bay Area at the time, working as Rosie the Riveters or tow truck drivers and engineers and other people that worked on the Bay Bridge. I'm going to share a few clips from the World War II generation who actually watched the bridge as it was originally constructed.
Okay, I think the first clip that we have is by a man named Ralph Anderson. So let's hear what Ralph has to say.
It was going to be wonderful. I didn't realize that the ferries wouldn't be there anymore. But to go across the bridge on the Key System train, the whole lower deck was trucks and trains, and that worked out great. I thought that was a good system, and to go across the bridge for a quarter. that I was impressed, and pretty soon the bridge is going to be paid for, and you wouldn't have to pay anything.
Well, now, what was this Key System train, and why don't we have it now? He said it was dedicated to trains and trucks.
That's right. The lower deck of the Bay Bridge, as it was initially constructed, included what we'd now call a light rail system, a train called the Key System that was throughout the Bay Area at that time. And the Key System was initially included as crossing over the Bay Bridge on the lower deck. The other side of the lower deck included commercial trucks, traffic. And on the top deck, traffic running either way was automobiles. And so he's talking about the initial construction of how it was that was later converted in the late 1950s and early 1960s.
Oh, so we lost that in the early 60s.
One of the interesting things, too, about this whole series is learning about some of the failed proposals that we've had for bridges, including a span that would have run similarly from the Bay Bridge from over Alameda, south of the current Bay Bridge into San Francisco to alleviate some of that traffic congestion that was building up very early on the Bay Bridge. It exceeded all traffic projections almost right away.
Hmm. Well, that kind of explains part of why, you know, Mr. Anderson said, we're going to pay 25 cents a toll and this bridge is going to be paid for and we'll just be able to go on it. But since there's always work that has to be done, I guess that's why toll bridges, which are always promised to be free eventually, are never, ever free. Would that be correct?
It's a remarkable thing. When I've done interviews now with individuals who work on the bridge, one of the things that's just absolutely amazed me is what an active structure it is. The amount of traffic and the number of people that cross the Bay Bridge means that people have to be towed across if their car breaks down. There are, of course, suicides. There are terrible accidents. And on top of that, the process, the way people have worked has changed on the bridge from the time that it initially started. Like Bay Bridge painters, for instance, new rules and regulations that have come in mean that for their actual work, it takes them longer to paint the Bay Bridge. But the reason for that is to actually keep the bay that's below them healthy. Before, the paint would just go directly into the bay. And now with new environmental concerns, new laws that regulate that, it does take much longer to paint the Bay Bridge. But the reason for that is so that we can have a healthy bay.
Well, let's hear another one of the clips that you brought us. This is Norma Gray. She lives in Berkeley now, but she came as a young girl. But, well, let's just hear what she has to say.
In 1936, they just kind of summarily announced that we were going to California. And it was precisely because my dad could not find a job. Yeah. And so he borrowed $100 from his brother, put his three little girls and what possessions he could put in a Model T Ford, and drove across the country.
Wow.
And stopped in Berkeley, California. Their plan was San Francisco, but it cost 25 cents to go across the new Bay Bridge.
25 cents to cross the Bay Bridge, and that was literally more money than they wanted to spend to come to San Francisco. Talk a little bit about what 25 cents means.
In those days, that would have been maybe not a significant amount. My narrator actually reminded me after that, but it would have been enough to probably buy a meal for the evening for the family. And so that it I think puts in context how hard times really were. And actually, it gives us a little bit of an insight into some of the folks who found work on the Bay Bridge, not unlike Norma Gray's father, who packed all of their family and their possessions into a Model T Ford and would have come to the Bay Area seeking work. And job openings at either the Golden Gate Bridge or the Bay Bridge would have looked pretty darn appealing at that time, even though they were pretty dangerous jobs. You can see differences in terms of safety, in terms of pay, in terms of all sorts of workplace conditions changing over the course of building new bridges. People will look at the old Bay Bridge or they'll look at the Golden Gate Bridge and they'll say, gee, these were completed on time and on budget.
And they still work.
And they still work. But, you know, on the other hand, it's because of a lot of a remarkable range of changes in labor that are actually good changes in many respects.
That's Sam Redman of UC Berkeley's Regional Oral History Office. He spoke with KALW's Stephen Short. Do you remember when the first Bay Bridge opened? Rojo would like to hear from you, and so would we. You can find more information at kalw.org. That's also where you can find all of our stories and subscribe to our podcast. You've been listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. Today's team includes Isabel Angel, Julie Kane, Leela Day, Audrey Dilling, Panina Eilberg-Schwartz, Laura Flynn, Angela Johnston, Ashley Ann Krigbaum, Erica Moo, Seth Samuel, Raisu Sussman, Judy Silber, and Stephen Short. Today's show was engineered by Chris Hoff. Casey Miner is our senior editor. Our managing editor is Martina Castro. Ben Trefney is our executive editor. And thanks to you, we are listener-supported radio. For Cross Currents, I'm Holly Kernan.